One of my favorite things about science fiction is that it takes your mind out of our normal world. And throughout the ages, the human mind has come up with astounding stories. The goal of this podcast is to give you a taste of some amazing stories written in an older time.
This is Adam Tagaro, and I present to you Yesterday's Sci-Fi. For an instant, she leaned close toward me.
I am Tan, the wife of Taro, the Lay.
Her voice barely whispered it.
You say nothing. I come again with Taro's plan to help you. We would save you and your Earth if we can.
Silent, Shorty and I just stared. Then she had turned and was gone. The rock panel slid closed upon us. The Juggernaut of Space, by Ray Cummings. This is the second part of a two-part podcast for this story. I must explain now what was happening to Mac and Vivian, as they afterward told it to me. Mac recalls quite clearly that moment of dazed, numbed anguish when he writhed on the ground with the horrible, sapping gaze of the Radic ruler upon him. Then he heard Vivian scream, saw her rushing at the shriveled old Radic. He called,
"Vivian, run, they'll kill you."
He found himself staggering to his feet, stumbling until he was by her side. He felt her clutch him, both of them standing there, numbed and dazed, terrified, with the feeling that the rushing Radics would instantly kill them. He remembers that the girl and himself took a stumbling step forward. To Mac, it was like stumbling through a suddenly appearing black curtain of emptiness. Just an abyss of soundless nothingness, except that there seemed still to be Vivian's clutch on his arm. No, it was her hand holding his, as they stood peering at a distant blur of red radiance.
"Viv, where are we? What happened?"
"Pete, I'm frightened. Can't see anything."
But the red radiance was growing, spreading to dispel the blank, empty darkness so that in a moment he could see the drab, disheveled form of the girl beside him, her moist, cold hand convulsively clutching his, and the red light on her pallid, terrified face. And in the distance now, there were outlines, a sort of red line that looked like a shimmering cliff with jagged spires upstanding in a row.
"Vivian, everything's gone. The Radics? We're not where we were. Bob and Shorty are gone."
The red glow, in a moment, had brightened to be far more luminous than they remembered it in the caverns. Obviously, there was a sky overhead now, a lurid, murky, blood-red haze of infinite distance. This was the outer surface of the little planetoid, the realm of the deathless monsters. Mac realized it with a shudder of terror. He and Vivian could now see that they were standing upon a little rise of ground in what could have been called a forest. Everywhere, great stalks of spindly blue and gray vegetation towered into the air. Growing things of fantastic shape, woven in places to be a solid jungle. Or again, there were open glades of rocky ground, buttes and little spires, small ravines and crevices, all of it bathed in crimson, as though here were a bloody landscape of unutterable horror. The horror of things not yet seen. Things lurking.
"Oh, Pete, what can we do?"
Hungry and faint, she swayed against him, but in the blood-red light she was trying to smile.
"You tell us what we ought to do. I will help us do it, Pete. I'm not afraid."
But the terror of despair was clutching at both of them. Mac tried to gather his wits. Alone here on an alien world, could they find food and drink? Wander here until some ghastly monster engulfed them? Or should they try to get back underground? Why? To have the murderous Radics fall upon them and kill them? But the will to live in every human is very strong. No one will lie down and just hopelessly wait for death.
"Viv, those cliffs over there. Cliffs with the spires. There ought to be tunnels, maybe at the bottom of them. If we could get back, maybe get to Bob and Shorty."
His voice trailed away. It all seemed so hopeless. Then he felt the girl clutch at his arm.
"Look, maybe that's water. I'm so thirsty."
"I see it. Maybe it is. Come on."
In a nearby open glade, surrounded by stalks of the towering fibrous vegetation, what could have been a shallow pool of water was spread on the open rocks. A little pool, 20 feet or so in diameter. Rivulets extended off to the sides of it and crevices of the rock surfaces. It was quite shallow, seemingly only a few inches deep. The red radiant glow that suffused everything stained it like blood, but it was translucent so that the rocks showed through it. Was it water? As they approached, Vivian stepped over one of the branching rivulet arms. The translucent red stuff suddenly lifted from the rocks, the little tentacle arm of it wrapping itself around her ankle. The girl screamed. In a panic, Mac reached down, plucking at the red mass. Ghastly horror! It was like quivering sticky glue. Frantically, he tore at it, warm, pulsating protoplasm. It stuck to his fingers, greedily fastening upon his flesh until he wiped it away. Vivian, too, was frantically flailing at this stuff. And in that second, Mac was aware that the whole 20-foot spread of it on the rocks was in motion now, rolling itself up from the rocks, congealing, gathering itself into a great circular mass. Huge 8-foot ball of blood-red pulsating protoplasm. Yet now it seemed there was a nucleus. A little central part, more solid than the rest, suddenly growing to look almost like a head and face in the center of a mass. Red gleaming eyes, a sucking mouth yawning. All this Mac saw in a horrified second or two while he was flailing to cast away the broken pulpy arm of the monster, and he saw now that the great ball of it was rocking. Then it started to roll and bump toward them. "Vivian, run! Good Lord, here it comes!" They fled, but behind them it was coming, gathering speed, bumping and squishing over the rocks. Mac tried to keep his wits. The monstrous thing was only 20 feet behind them now. And as it rolled, it was expanding, a lashing ball twice as high as their heads. Then ahead of them, Mac saw a narrow pass between two huge rocks, a space some 3 feet wide. He shoved Vivian into it, a space too small for the monster to follow. It was a crevice only some 10 feet long. They dashed through it. Mac turned to see what the crimson deathless thing would do. It had hit the rocks, and now it was oozing through the narrow space, thin red streamer of protoplasm feeding itself through the crevice. Mac and Vivian had fled to one side, and as the jet of red pulp came through, out on the other side it rolled itself into a ball again, ghastly thing that kept on going down the slope. In a moment it was 100 feet away. Panting, Mark clutched his companion, and they stared. The bumping, rolling circular mass had reached a patch of forest. It slowed and stopped.
"Pete, look!"
The girl's terrified, odd voice murmured it.
"Look at it now!"
There in the forest glade, the monstrous crimson ball was sagging, flattening, spreading itself out into a thin, translucent layer on the rocky ground. Then it was motionless, quiescent, waiting.
"Well," Mac breathed, "at least we know now what to avoid. We..."
But again Vivian gripped him.
"What's that over there?"
Her shaking hand gestured to one side. It was an upright blob moving in a patch of trees. A tree hit it, then it showed again. It stopped, seemed to turn upon itself, still upright, then moved again. Suddenly Mac gasped.
"A man! Look, see it now, a man! What, it's Blaine!"
Startled relief was in his voice. The figure came to another open space, where the crimson glow in the air showed it plainly. It was Blaine. He was moving along, gazing around as though searching.
"Blaine! Blaine!" Mac called.
The banker turned at the voice, saw Mac and Vivian, who now were running toward him.
"You, Mac, Vivian, you're safe."
"Yes, sure."
It was a blessed relief to Mac.
"I've been looking for you," Blaine called.
He was running to meet them.
"And I've got something important, a weapon."
The three reached each other. Blaine and Mac gripped hands. Then suddenly Vivian gasped.
Another of those things!
Out among the trees, beyond where Blaine had been a moment before, a slithering red shape was visible. Another of the deathless things which soundlessly had been stalking Blaine. Like a huge 30-foot crimson python, it was sliding through the vegetation. Its neck and head came up, reared up as for a second it stopped, peering with red-green eyes seeking its prey. Then it lowered its head and came slithering rapidly forward. I must go back now for just a moment to recount what happened to Blaine. From that moment when the Raddock guards hustled him away from their shriveled ancient ruler. Ignoring his protests, he was shoved along in a corridor, thrown into a cave cell, and its door slide closed upon him. But he wasn't alone there for long. Presently, the slide opened again and a figure came in. It was obviously a Raddock, but of somewhat of a different type. The same square, powerful look. But this one was taller, almost as tall as Blaine. Gray-skinned, lean, and muscular. He seemed fairly young, 30 Earth years perhaps.
"I have come forward to talk to you," the visitor announced.
He sat stiffly on a rock by a wall of the cave. His gray-black woven garment swished as he motioned Blaine to sit on the ground before him.
"You are very interesting to me. Sit down."
"Thanks. I'll stand," Blaine said. "You speak my language very well."
"That I should."
The Raddock smile made his strange face wrinkle into a grimace.
"I am Ratan. Our great mind sent me to your Earth. I picked you Earthmen and ordered you seized. I will tell you about that. You can be very helpful to us, I am thinking. Perhaps especially so. I am commanded to tell you our plans."
Carefully, Blaine listened to the strange things this Ratan quite calmly was telling him. With their weird mechanisms, the Raddocks were now directing their tiny world through space toward our Earth. Already they were bathing Earth with a radiance which was disturbing the Earth's axial and orbital rotations, that vague, dim purple haze which Dr. Johns had described to Shorty and me. Then, when Xelos was closer to Earth, the vibratory beam would be intensified. The Earth would be drawn from its orbit. Engulfed in this weird gravitational force, it would follow Xelos back from the Sun, out into interplanetary space. The abduction of Earth. Blaine knew little of science, but enough to realize what soon would happen on Earth.
"Storms, the disturbance of all your atmospheric pressures,"
Ratan was saying with his ironic smile.
"That will very soon kill many of your people. And then will come the congealing cold. Certain it is that human life on your Earth will not withstand it."
Our atmosphere not adapted to insulate the cold of space. There was no need for this Ratan to picture for Blaine the wild devastation of Earth.
"Perhaps even before we have drawn you out to the orbit of Saturn," Ratan was saying. "Then there will be no Earthman still living."
The end of human Earth life. It might take another Earth year or many, but it was coming. Inevitable. A thing the Raddock great mind had long planned. And that already was being successfully accomplished. There on Earth, now as I write this brief narrative, many scientists working to understand the theories of the strange diabolic mechanisms of the bandit Crimson Comet. The projection of some new application of gravitational force. The purple ray was something of that nature, of course. A link between Xelos and Earth. Like a chain binding them together, a powerful little tug pulling a great ocean liner. And the same force, unquestionably, was what made Xelos itself mobile in space. That much we know definitely because in miniature, but doubtless of the same approximate nature, the purple gravitational ray is the motive power for the Raddock spaceship, which we now have intact.
"So you are planning to kill everyone on Earth," Blaine said. His heart was pounding, but he tried to hold his voice calm.
He stood with folded arms, gazing at Ratan. "And what will that gain you?"
"Our little planet here we do not like," Ratan retorted. "Many spaceships we will build, and when your Earth people are gone, then we will migrate to your much better world. The Lay and the Raddocks to rule them. The Great Mind has planned it all. We have been secretly to your Earth. We have studied life there. It will be much better for us than this. The Great Mind will rule your whole world for a while, until he dies. And then, do you not see something unusual in me?"
"What?" Blaine demanded.
"I am the appointed one to be the next Great Mind. When I was born, it was decided. I have been trained for that. Just for that, nothing else."
Blaine could see it in him now. That air of quiet, confident dominance.
"I see what you mean," Blaine agreed. "I am like that on Earth. You realize it?"
"It is why I chose to bring you here," Ratan said.
"I can be very helpful to you," Blaine added. My companions, they are just captives. But I would like to be more than that. The banker shrugged. I bow to the inevitable. If you are to seize my world, then I would like to do the best for myself. That's good sense, isn't it? Was he gaining this fellow's confidence? The big Raddick smiled also.
What do you mean?
On Earth, I am very powerful. I have money, property.
Of what good could that be to me?
Ratan smiled.
And when I get there, I have it all anyway.
What I mean, Blaine persisted, I'm an organizer. I know the resources of Earth.
And to that I agree,
Ratan interrupted.
You mean you would join us as a friend?
For a position of power among you Raddicks, yes. You will find I can handle the lay. He smiled cannily. On Earth they called me ruthless. I could bend men to my will, and always to my own profit. Blaine's keen, appraising gaze was watching the Raddick. Ratan was smiling. He could understand talk like this, and it was obvious that he liked it. Blaine's heart was pounding. At Ratan's broad gray belt, a little pot-bellied metal cylinder was hanging. He gestured to it casually. What is that, Ratan?
That? It is a weapon of ours. Very important. There are only very few of us who may carry it. A rack gun, perhaps your language would term it.
Let me see it. How does it work? But Ratan was only fingering it lovingly. He made no move to detach it from his belt. He was smiling.
It is what brought you from Earth.
He seemed willing enough to describe it. The projection of a vibration akin to thought waves, but infinitely more intense. In effect, it paralyzed the conscious mind, yet left the motor area intact. The victim, to all intents and purposes, was a somnambulist. The subconscious mind, with willpower numbed, then was open to any suggestive stimulus which it received. The victim's muscles instinctively obeyed commands, and the memory areas recorded nothing. Shorty and I had seen it happen to Vivian and Mac. Blaine did not know of that, but it happened to him on Earth, as it had to all of us.
And then after a time it wears off?
Exactly. An hour. What you would call an hour on Earth, perhaps. But another shock of it can be given. You were under its influence for about 3 weeks, the time it took for our spaceship to bring us here.
And you fed me very badly, Blaine commented. He was taut inside now. He took a casual step forward so that he was almost within reach of the seated Raddick. Is that thing easy to operate? Blaine's heart leapt as Ratan unclipped the little cylinder from his belt.
Very simple, the Raddick said. Just a pressure on this little lever. But it will be years before the Great Mind or myself would let you handle one of these.
I was thinking, Blaine said, when we get to Earth, you yourself will not be the Great Ruler. But if, perhaps, the Great Mind should suddenly die, then it would be only the Great Ratan, with me to help him. Blaine had leaned forward confidently and lowered his voice. Did you ever think of that? Surely at least the idea of murdering his commander was startling to Ratan. And for that instant he was off his guard. Just a second, but it was enough for Blaine. The banker abruptly reached, snatched the cylinder, and leapt backwards.
Now, you damned villain!
Blaine raised the cylinder level. With a roar, Ratan was on his feet. There was a soundless, vague little flash. Ratan, tensing his muscles for a leap, abruptly relaxed, wavered.
Quiet now. Stand still,
Blaine ordered sharply. He stood listening, with the quiescent blankly staring Ratan before him. Had Ratan's roar of startled anger aroused any guards out in the corridor? It seemed not. There was only silence.
Now we will go out of here, Blaine said softly. We will go out. You know where Robert Rance is now. You will lead me to him.
With hands outstretched, the big Raddick moved to the door, slid it open. At this moment, Shorty and I were confined in another cave cell not far away. Ratan knew it. He was leading Blaine there. But suddenly, at a corridor intersection, voices sounded. Raddicks were coming.
Crouch down, Blaine commanded. Be quiet. Not a sound from you.
There was a wall recess. Blaine shoved his numbed captive into it. Together, they crouched.
And now Blaine saw that in a sheath at Ratan's belt, there was a knife. He drew it out, held it in his other hand, and kept the cylinder ready. Two Radix were coming. They were talking together in their own language. They stopped nearby, evidently with the intention of parting here at the intersection. Blaine listened. Then he whispered to Ratan,
"Answer me softly. What are they saying? Tell me in English." "Those Earth people banished into the realm of deathless monsters, and they will die, of course."
Ratan's words were mumbled, queerly mouthed, like one who talks in his sleep. Blaine assumed that all of us were out there on the upper surface, not just Vivian and Mac. Swiftly, he changed his plans.
"In a moment when I command you," he whispered, "you will lead me there. You know where the Earth people would probably be now, out which exit they went. Answer me softly."
"By the big cliff with the rock spires. The exit down the left corridor."
Tensely, Blaine waited. The nearby Radix parted and moved away.
"Now lead me," he whispered.
Again they moved forward, down the left-hand corridor branch now. And suddenly, behind Blaine, there was a shout. He whirled. One of the Radix had changed his mind and was coming back, calling something to his fellow. Blaine had no time to get himself and Ratan out of sight. The Radix saw them, saw the stiffly walking Ratan, and Blaine with the cylinder in his hand. With a startled shout, the little Radix leaped at Blaine. The flash met him. He stopped in his tracks, stood stiff. But from the other direction, his companion was coming. And now the commotion was bringing others. Blaine could hear several of the guttural voices and the thuds of their oncoming footsteps. With a leap, Blaine went past Ratan. The squat little shape of the other Radix came charging down the center of the narrow corridor. His greenish eye beams were weird in the crimson gloom. Again, Blaine fired the cylinder, but this time evidently he missed, and in another second the Radix was on him. The shock of the impact flung them both to the ground. The cylinder was knocked from Blaine's hand. He felt his adversary's arms clutching him, squeezing him with machine-like strength. In another moment, Blaine's ribs would have been smashed, but his left hand still gripped the knife. With despairing effort, he drove it into the Radix's side. Ghastly knife thrust. It went in with a crunch, a rasp as it severed the strange flesh. There was a hiss as hot fluid spurted. The Radix's scream was horrible. His arms fell away. Blaine disentangled himself. On the ground near him, he saw the cylinder, snatched it, dropped it into his pocket. A commotion was all around him now, oncoming Radix in several of the branching corridors. But ahead of Blaine, there seemed no one. He ran. Behind him, he could dimly see the squat little figures gazing at their dead fellow and surrounding the stricken Ratan. No one seemed to notice the fleeing Blaine as he ran the length of the winding corridor until at last he was out upon the crimson upper surface. For a time, he wandered. He did not see any of the crimson monsters, or at least did not recognize them for what they were. Then he heard Mac shouting at him, saw Mac and Vivian running toward him.
"I've got something important! A weapon!" he called to Mac.
Then abruptly the three of them saw that huge python-like crimson thing which had been silently stalking Blaine.
"Look!" Vivian gasped. "Another of them!"
It was slithering rapidly at them now, no more than 50 feet away. Its green swaying eye beams clung to them. For that instant they were standing stricken with terror. To one side of them there was the brink of an abyss a few yards away, and to the other, and behind them, a ragged little cliff.
"Gotta try to climb those rocks," Mac gasped. "Can't get past that snake thing. We're trapped."
But Blaine swept him aside. The cylinder was in Blaine's hand now.
"This will stop it," he muttered. "You two, get behind me."
The monstrous 30-foot thing was only half its own length away from them now. Then, as its head reared over a projection of the uneven rocky ground, Blaine carefully aimed the cylinder and fired. But the monster didn't stop. There was no conscious, thinking brain in that ghastly, pulsating crimson head, just motor ganglia reacting to the impulses of instinct. Blaine fired again, but the monster kept on coming, and in another second was upon them. Back in our cave cell, Shorty and I stared blankly after the figure of the lay woman, Tan, as she motioned to the Raddick guards who slid our door panel closed. Again, we were alone.
Well, Shorty murmured, what do you make of that? The wife of some lay named Taro, she said.
And that she would come back and try to get us out of here. That her husband had some plan. Eagerly, Shorty and I waited. Would it be an hour or a day? Both of us were thinking of Blaine, locked somewhere around here, perhaps in a cell like ours. Or had the Raddicks killed him by now? And Vivian and Mac, wandering out there in the realm of the things you couldn't kill.
I guess they're done for, Shorty said when I mentioned them.
Unless we can get out there to them. Shorty's smile was ironic.
That would fix everything, of course. Don't be an ass, Bob. If we were out there, we'd all be trying to get back.
For what? So the Raddicks would jump on us and kill us. It was all so utterly hopeless. But it was queer, that instinct all five of us had to try and keep together. The young lay woman had brought us food and drink. Shorty and I slumped on the earthen floor now and sampled the food. Nauseous stuff, indescribable.
If it's been weeks since we left Earth, Shorty said, no wonder we're nearly starved to death.
But we managed to eat and drink some of it. And then, exhausted by the nerve tension of what we had been through, we drifted off into an uneasy slumber. The rasp of the sliding door panel jerked us into alertness. I had the feeling that only a little time had passed. The panel slid open just a foot or two, and a figure came in. It was Tan. Both Shorty and I were on our feet.
You came as you hoped, I said softly. We're ready. Just tell us what you want us to do.
She barely whispered.
The Raddick guards just now are changing. There is no one outside. We go quickly.
Go where?
Shorty demanded.
To my husband, Taro. He is in a corridor near here. Come now, quickly.
The faintly red corridor outside was empty. Swiftly, Tan led us along it, around several sharp bends, past a cross-corridor intersection. I was tense, expecting every moment that Raddicks would leap upon us from the shadows. But so far we had escaped notice, though obviously there were many Raddicks near here. Several times we passed the dim oval openings of little grottos, and often there were guttural chattering voices from within them.
Won't the guards discover we're gone?
Shorty murmured.
Perhaps not for maybe much time. I am in charge of you. I bring you food and drink. The guards stay outside, should you try to break out.
Our tunnel was descending now, and suddenly from the dimness to one side there came a murmur.
Tan! Tan!
A young lay man was crouching in a shadowed recess. It was Tan's husband, Taro.
She has brought you Earthmen. That is good.
We crouched down with him. He was a youngish fellow, tall, slim, and powerfully built. His single-draped garment exposed one bronze shoulder. His gray-black hair was chopped at the base of his neck, with a narrow band of bright-colored fabric tied around his forehead. With his high cheekbones, hawk-like nose, and gleaming dark eyes, he could have been a young stalwart of Earth.
I want to help you, he was saying. Your coming here fits my plans, and believe me, I have worked on them a long time. Tan and I, making the Raddicks trust us.
Say, Shorty murmured, you certainly are fluent with English.
The young lay's face wrinkled into a smile.
Why should I not, my wife and I? We lay learn things quickly, perhaps a different mind quality from yours, almost at once to absorb what we hear.
Ratan, he is next to the great mind as leader of the Raddicks. He chose Tan and me to go on the expedition to Earth.
We were carefully watched, or we would have escaped to warn you. It was Tan who took care of you on the way here.
He told us then of the weird Raddick gun with its flash of mind current, the weapon which probably just at this exact moment, no more than a half a mile away in this maze of subterranean corridors, Blaine was snatching from Ratan. And Tan told us, too, of the Raddick plot to devastate Earth.
You have some plan?
Shorty murmured. He told us then that he knew how to get into the Cavern of Machines, a huge guarded grotto where all the diabolical giant mechanisms of the Raddicks were housed. The power plant of Little Zelos, and the source of the purple radiance which was bathing Earth.
If we can kill the guards and get into the cavern, only the Great Mind himself, or Ratan, will be there. No one else but those two are allowed there. No one else knows the secrets of the mechanisms to operate them.
So we just get in and overcome the great mind himself? Shorty commented. He gave a mock shudder with an attempt to be humorous.
All right, figure that's done. Then what?
Taro's plan was certainly desperate, but at least it promised the possibility of success.
Do you know where the Earthman Blaine is? I demanded.
Tan said, He is in a cave cell. I am ordered to take him food and drink very soon.
What weapons have you got? Shorty asked. Say, if you could get one of those brain-paralyzing guns...
Taro shook his head.
Never could I even get near one. The Great Mind always carries one, and so does Ratan, but there is no chance.
We must get to Blaine, I said.
And then try to find Vivian and Mac. We've all got to be together.
We planned it for a few moments more. Then, cautiously, Taro and Tan led us to a corridor intersection.
We will hide here, he said, gesturing to another shadowed recess where the ragged rocks of the wall jutted out in an overhang. Tan can go best.
The young Lei turned to his wife.
Tan, listen. You get food and drink. You take it to Blaine's cell. There are not always guards, perhaps. You watch your chance.
Listen, Shorty suddenly interjected. Maybe I'm crazy, but there's some kind of commotion around here.
We could all hear it now. A distant murmur of turmoil down one of the side corridors. Taro nodded.
Something is wrong, and Blaine's cell is down that way. You Earthmen wait here. I will go with Tan. Then we come back to you.
They were gone only a few moments. From a little distance they had stood unnoticed, watching and listening. Blaine had escaped. He had seized Ratan's thought gun, turned it upon Ratan and one of the guards, had stricken them, and had knifed another guard, and vanished.
Well, good for Blaine, Shorty murmured. He's smarter than all the rest of us put together, and he's got one of those guns. Where'd he go?
They think perhaps to the outer surface, Taro said. He ran that way.
To find Mac and Vivian, I exclaimed.
Well, that's what we want to do. Show us that exit, Taro.
I will go with you, the young Lei said quietly.
But there was no mistaking his shudder and the grim look on his face.
Tan, you stay here.
I will go with my husband, she retorted. Taro, please.
We took her. It seemed that the commotion at Blaine's cell must have drawn all the Radics from these other passages. We were not discovered as we threaded our way back, until presently we were ascending a winding tunnel which ended at the crimson upper surface. How long it took us to sight Mac, Vivian, and Blaine, I do not know. It seemed an eternity of apprehension, as Taro and Tan cautiously led us along winding rocky defiles and past patches of that weird, fantastic forest. Shorty and I saw none of the monsters, but there were many times when suddenly, without explanation, Taro turned us from where we would have wandered. Then we were far enough from the tunnel entrances so that we dared talk without possibility that the Radics would hear us.
Blaine! Blaine, where are you? Mac, Vivian, are you here?
It was Tan who first saw them. We were in a cluster of rocks with the brink ahead of us. I could see the lower ground, perhaps 50 feet down, a precipitous descent close ahead of us. It chanced that Tan was leading, and suddenly she turned, gave a cry, and then pointed over the brink.
There they are! Down there! Look! Look at them!
We crowded to the brink. 50 feet down this ragged wall, Blaine, Vivian, and Mac stood backed against it. An abyss was near them. And in front of them a great crimson, python-like thing was slithering, almost upon them now, with Blaine futilely firing his gun at it. There was nothing we could do, and for those seconds all four of us stood staring, mute, numbed with horror. The scene on the ledge below us was clear as though on a little stage. The monster in another second would be upon his victims. I saw Blaine throw down his gun in despair. His voice floated up to us.
Damn thing won't work! Gotta try to run!
Then, suddenly, we saw Mac leap forward. Not toward where he might have a wild chance of climbing up our ragged little cliff wall, but the other way, toward the brink that dropped down to another terrace, between the brink and the monster's slithering length. His intention was obvious, to lead the monster over that other brink after him, to sacrifice himself so that his companions might escape. In the chaos of that second, we saw Mac get past the monster's head and neck. Its head turned, and then, before Mac could hurl himself down the 100-foot drop, a loop of the great crimson body lashed out. It seemed that a tentacle whipped separate from the undulating snake-like body, a tentacle that seized Mac, looped around him, and flung him into the air. Just a ghastly second or two as Mac's whirling body came up diagonally toward us in the air, and then fell back into a ragged cluster of rocks beyond the monster's tail. Horribly, we could hear the thud as it struck. For another second, the great crimson head of the monster seemed to rear, with swaying eye beams searching, but Mac's body was hidden by the rock cluster. Then suddenly, the gruesome python shape, head down, began oozing over the brink beside it. Flowing mass of protoplasm. It thinned out as it sagged down the 100-foot drop, thinned until it was narrow ribbon, a blood-red rivulet of waterfall. Then it was all on the lower level, gathering itself together until in a moment it was a great congealed, quivering crimson ball with the head in the center. For another instant it pulsated, then it bumped and rolled down a ragged slope, reached a little patch of distant vegetation where we could dimly see it spreading itself thinly out. Spread like a blood-red pool, quiescent, waiting. With Taro and Tan, Shorty and I climbed down the ragged little descent, joined Vivian and Blaine.
"He tried to save us," the white-faced Vivian murmured.
"Yes," I agreed, "we saw it."
We found his broken body in the cluster of rocks 50 feet away. He was still conscious, but we thought he was dying. One of his arms hung limp. Blood was coming from a head wound, but his pallid face was trying to smile.
"My leg and arm," he mumbled. "Can't move them."
One of his legs undoubtedly was broken. As we told him that the monster had gone, his gaze seemed only on Vivian.
"Thought it would kill you, Viv," he muttered. "Didn't want that."
Then he fainted. He had been trying to get up on one elbow as Vivian knelt with an arm under his head. Then his eyes closed and he sagged, went limp. "We must stop that blood from his head," Tan murmured, "and then try to get him into one of the tunnels." Vivian jumped up.
"Here's what we need. Bandages."
She flashed us a little twisted smile as she tore off her waist and skirt and ripped them into strips.
"Here, bandages."
She handed the strips of fabric to Tan. Then she grinned at me.
"This underdress, not too becoming, is it?"
She gestured at the brief undergarment that now partly covered her, and her whimsical smile broadened.
"Well, this time anyway, I had a good motive, didn't I?"
Shorty and I carried the still unconscious Mac back to one of the tunnel entrances, and Taro led us into a shadowed, cave-like little place where we laid him down. Good luck seemed with us. We had encountered, so far, no Radix. "You and Tan will stay with him," I told Vivian. And Shorty and I had decided that Blaine had best stay also. For once, Blaine had to do something against his will.
"Think I'm too old to help you young fellows now?" he said.
"All right, maybe I am." Certainly he was in no physical condition to be much help in the desperate venture we were planning. He handed me the Radic gun, showed me how to use it. I dropped it into my pocket. "Good luck to you," Blaine said.
"Thanks. We'll need it," I acknowledged.
Then Shorty, Taro, and I left them. Taro had hidden the only weapons he could get near here. We found them, sheathed knives that the Lay used in the underground fields. They were odd-shaped knives. They seemed made of a highly polished metallic stone. I thumbed one. It was sharp.
"Very handy," Shorty commented.
"Come on, Taro, let's go. Where is this cavern of machines?"
It was perhaps half an earth mile, low down in the maze of underground passages. Shorty clutched his knife. I held the Radic gun as we followed Taro down the dim, descending crimson tunnel.
"There's one of the guards," Shorty whispered. "See him?"
I pushed Shorty back.
"No, two of them. The other one's sitting down.
You and Taro keep behind me. I'll tackle them with the Radic gun."
We could see the square gray figures of two Radics down the little length of tunnel ahead of us. They were by an opening that seemed to lead sharply downward, with a glow of radiance streaming up. And now, in the heavy underground silence, we could hear the faint, muffled thrum and whine of mechanisms. My hand silently gripped Taro. All three of us crouched.
"That's the entrance to the Cavern of Machines?" I whispered.
Yes. Two guards. Are there liable to be more of them around?
Taro shook his head. I think not, though I cannot surely say.
The machines are operating, Shorty said. Hear them? That means only the great mind of Ratan will be down there in the cavern?
Yes, the young Lay agreed.
It's most likely not Ratan, I said. Blaine's got him, struck him insensible. Or would he be recovered by now?
Taro had no way of guessing. With an ordinary Radic, the shock would have lasted longer than this.
But Ratan's mind is trained, developed, more powerful, as you would say. He could recover more quickly. Are there other entrances? Shorty asked. They'd have guards at them. If we make any commotion down there and a bunch of Radics came rushing...
This is the only entrance.
Right, Shorty chuckled. Come on, then. Let's finish off these fellows.
He fingered his knife.
You tackle them with that gun, Bob. If you miss, trust me. I'll slip this knife into them.
With Taro and Shorty behind me, I crept soundlessly forward. In my hand, the pot-bellied little Radic gun, so unfamiliar, gave me an uneasy feeling. Suppose I should miss. An uproar from these guards might bring dozens of others.
How close do I have to get?
I whispered to Taro. This now, close enough. One of the Radics was standing up, lounging with his back to the wall. The other was lying down. To send my flash clinging to the heads of both of them, I would have to shift my aim and fire twice. My hand trembled a little. Then I pressed the lever. There was that vaguely visible flash. The gun hilt in my grip vibrated, and at the muzzle of it there was a faint little hiss. A hit! The Radic on the ground seemed to stiffen. He raised his head, staring blankly. The Radic who was standing noticed it. He started, whirled around toward us. It took all my willpower to withhold my second flash for that instant, but I did. And then, as the standing figure steadied, I fired again.
Got him! Shorty murmured. Good work, Bob. Come on.
We ran forward. The standing Radic was motionless, gazing with vacant stare. Shorty dashed up to him.
Lie down. You're asleep. If you're not, you ought to be.
But the Radic did not move, just turned his empty gaze toward the sound of Shorty's voice. I got it. They don't speak English. Tell them, Taro. The Lay murmured commandingly in his own language, and in a moment the two guards were lying inert with closed eyes.
Mighty neat, Shorty whispered. Come on, here we go.
Beyond the guards, an earthen ramp led sleepily downward, winding to a circular spiral. Then, presently, we emerged upon a little ledge with the great cavern of machines spread out before us.
Crouch down, we will see who is here, Taro whispered.
There was awe in his voice. We must not be seen until we attack. It was a huge vault-like cavern, with glowing roof high over our heads, and we were about 20 feet above its lower level, with a narrow, steep ramp leading down from near us. I saw that it was a weird, dim grotto, lurid with swaying, prismatic glows of colored radiance, and throbbing, humming with a myriad mechanical voices. Distant railed terraces held frameworks of metal, where opalescent tubes were glowing. Beams of light radiance seemed to carry the power from one strange mechanism to the next, like wires connecting them in series. No Lay, no ordinary Radic, and certainly least of all us Earthmen, could by any chance have understood the scientific details of what we were seeing. I recall there was a convergence of beams high up in the midair at the center of the cavern, where a shower of tiny electrolyte sparks glittered like a fountain of pyrotechnics, and out of it a narrow concentrated beam of violet-purple glow shot upward to a grid in the ceiling, the gravitational force, doubtless, which from there was conducted to some point above where it was hurled into space. How long I stared, awed, I have no idea. Then I was aware of Taro beside me, whispering.
It is the great mind who is down there. He has just come into sight, down by that yellow glow.
The floor of the cavern held a dozen or more of the huge mechanisms, and in the center of them was a throbbing space that seemed to hold the controls of all these intricate machines. Down there in the weird glow we could now see the lone figure of the ancient Radic leader, shriveled and bent. He moved around, occasionally reaching to shift some lever or make some adjustment.
He must not see us coming, Taro whispered. His voice was tense.
and on his face now, as the multicolored glow bathed it, there was unmistakable terror. This young Lay, like all his people, born and bred to fear the dominance of the great mind, to attack that little figure, to Taro, was almost unthinkable. Taro had planned this, dreamed of it. But faced with it now, there was only terror sweeping him. So that had he been here alone, easily he could have turned and fled. Shorty and I had no such inhibitions.
"What in the devil?" Shorty murmured. "He's got a Radic gun, sure, I've no doubt of it. We've got to duck that. But once I get close to him..."
Shorty's gesture with his knife was significant. For minutes, we tensely waited. Then we got down the ramp without being seen, and on the lower floor we crouched between two of the giant whining machines.
"Easy now," I whispered. "You two, keep behind me."
I held the Radic gun in my hand. We waited another moment, then ducked forward and crouched again, behind a great glowing mechanism through which two beams of colored light were passing. We were only some 20 feet from the leader now, close enough for my shot, or for us to rush him. He was bending down over a glowing dial. Green light from it streamed upward, bathed his weird mummy-like countenance so that suddenly he seemed like some horrible ghoul intent upon a diabolical, gruesome task.
"Let him have it," Shorty whispered. "Now's your chance."
I must confess my heart was racing, with a sudden nameless premonition of terror. Thoughts are instant things. I tried to tell myself that this was just a weazened old man, helpless, with three of us about to leap on him. Of course he was helpless. With sudden relief, I saw that he had discarded his belt. It hung on the peg of a rack several feet away from him, his belt with the Radic gun. Shorty saw it at the same instant.
"There's his gun, Bob. He can't reach it. We've got him."
Of course. I leveled my weapon. I was sighting it. I shall always wonder if my racing thoughts were projected then to warn the Radic leader, or did he sense us in some other way? I was standing a little out into an aisle between two big mechanisms when suddenly he lifted his head, turned, and saw me. The movement and my own startled reaction spoiled my aim. Mustn't fire until I was sure. I recall that in that split second I was aware that the old Radic had not moved. He was just staring at me with glittering eyes and his shrunken gray face horrible with the intensity of his menace. He knew, of course, that he couldn't reach his weapon. He didn't try. Just a helpless, weazened old man, but as I sighted my gun I was aware of the power radiating from him. The power of his mind pitted now against mine, his will commanding me to drop my weapon and my own brain demanding my muscles to sight it, to fire it. Conflict most horrible. It was as though every fiber of me was being outraged, seared and torn, my nerves screaming and my mind was screaming, "Kill him! Got to kill him now! Don't drop the gun. Hold your fingers tight." But I could feel my fingers loosening their grip. The muzzle was swaying. Everything seemed blurring before me, swimming into a phantasmagoria of horror. It was all in a second or two. I heard Shorty mutter a startled oath beside me. But it was Taro, despite that he must have been unutterably frightened, who kept his wits. He uttered a grim shout, jumped to his feet, sideways away from me. It did what Taro had hoped. For just an instant that baleful gaze left me, fastened on Taro. Then it swung back, but in that instant I had recovered myself, leveled the gun, and fired. New horror. The Radic leader's gaze, again on me, seemed to meet the flash of my gun in midair between us. I could imagine there must have been a conflict there, a little almost soundless, almost invisible puff of deranged vibrations, and the derangement must have been forced backward to me. All in the flash of a thought. To my conscious mind, there was only my pressing the gun lever, and then a bursting explosion at my hand as the Radic gun flew into fragments. One of them struck my forehead. I staggered back and went down. But I was aware that Shorty, with Taro close after him, had leaped. Shorty, with knife upraised, his catapulting body hitting the crouching, ghoul-like figure. Shorty thinks now his knife never reached its mark. There was just the impact of his body, knocking the weazened figure backward. The Radic screamed a shrill, weirdly horrible cry, but it ended in a gurgle. Just for an instant, a gruesome liquid gurgle. Then there was only Shorty's gasp of horror. I was scrambling to my feet. I crouched, stricken, staring. Shorty had drawn back, standing, staring. And Taro, too, had checked his rush. All three of us froze with revulsion. On the floor, weird in a green-red glow from a nearby machine, the weazened mummy body of the Raddock lay huddled. A thing which had been nearly of all mental quality. And now it had encountered a physical blow, to which every atom of its weird makeup was foreign. And what a second before had been living, solid substance was now dissolving. The clothes sagged, deflated. A bubbling ooze was where the face had been. Just a brief moment, and then before us, the Raddock's garments lay crumpled and flat in a little pool of stenching putrescence. I turned away, sickened. Then Shorty recovered himself.
That damn thing screamed! Others will come!
Hurry now! Smash the machines! It is what we came for! Taro gasped. I made a leap for the control panels, then stopped, whirled around. There was a cry from behind and above me. On a narrow, railed little balcony which connected with the ramp down which we had come, the figure of a Raddock was standing. A tall, gray shape. It was Ratan, though I did not know who it was then. He had a knife in his hand, and he was in the act of leaping over the rail to land upon me. I had no time to avoid him. His body came sprawling, landed on my shoulders, bore me down. Simultaneously, I was aware that Shorty and Taro were smashing at the control apparatus. It crackled, tinkled like breaking glass, with a huge flash of colored light and sparks that sent Shorty and Taro reeling backward, dazed so that they did not see what was happening to me. Then they were up, at it again, hurling broken fragments of the controls at the nearby grids, tubes, and prisms. And in that same second, the multicolored flash spread, deranged, weird current. Like burning powder trains, it leaped everywhere around the grotto. Puffs, sparks of fountain glare, the hissing, whining, screeching of breaking machines. On the floor, I struggled with Ratan on top of me. He had no gun, just a long, thin knife with polished blade that glittered as he tried to thrust it into my throat. My own knife was gone. I reached, clutched at the gray wrist, turning the knife so that it went past my throat. Then I heaved upward. In the struggle, Ratan dropped his knife and neither of us could reach it. Locked together, we rolled, pummeling, scrambling. Then I knew that I had him. My fist landed on his hawk-nosed gray face, a solid blow that made him scream with revulsion and pain. Then I heaved him off, staggered to my feet. I seemed to be in a cloud of yellow-green, choking, acrid vapor, through which I could only dimly see Ratan struggling erect. And there was Shorty's voice.
Bob, where are you? Gotta get out of here. Taro!
It seemed that somewhere near me, Taro was coughing, choking. Then I realized that the shape of Ratan was plunging at me through the heavy chemical smoke. I was swaying, but I squared off, hit him solidly in the face again. He went down, and I leaped upon him, lifting his head and shoulders, and then banging his head back against the corner of a mechanism frame, pounding it again and again until suddenly I was aware that it had smashed and was dripping upon me. With a shudder, I cast the inert body away and leaped to my feet.
Bob, gotta get out of here! Taro!
Shorty was still shouting. Green-yellow vapor was swirling around me. Electrolyte flashes seemed everywhere. The whole grotto, an inferno of pyrotechnics. Then I saw the figure of Shorty staggering to help Taro from where he had fallen. I swayed and joined them.
That ramp! I gasped. Behind us, come on!
We tried to hold our breath as we staggered up the ramp. Then there seemed a little puff of breathable air. As we plunged into the exit tunnel, for an instant I turned. The big grotto was alive with swirling turgid smoke and flames and leaping, bursting light fire. And the bedlam of weird and bursting sounds. The death of the monstrous Raddock science screaming with its agony of disillusion. Coughing and choking, we ran up the tunnel, with the sounds and the glare fading behind us, and the pure air reviving us.
All the Raddocks will be after us, Shorty panted. Faster, Taro!
Distant cries were all around us in a maze of tunnels. The alarm was spreading everywhere. We saw a few plunging Raddock shapes, but were able to avoid them. Taro was leading us. I gripped him as we ran.
You say you know where they keep their space flyer?
Yes, not far from Blaine and the others. Then we reached the girls and Blaine, who were crouching in that tunnel recess with the still unconscious Mac. Vivian and Tan just stared at us white-faced, with little cries of relief. Blaine gasped, "You did it!" "We sure did," Shorty agreed. "Come on, the spaceship!" "You and I will carry Mac," I said. Shorty nodded, and we lifted him. Carrying Mac slowed us, but his emaciated body was light. In a moment, I slung him over my shoulders, and with Shorty steadying him, we made better speed. It wasn't far, but there were Raddick figures everywhere now. Weirdly, only one of them came near us. Shorty and Taro were ready to attack him. The squat little shape came plunging along a side tunnel, apparently heading for us. He seemed to be gibbering, mouthing, then screaming. But he ignored us, running, knife in hand, until he bashed himself into a rock. We ran on, and then suddenly I realized that we had emerged into that huge underground space where first we had met the Great Mind. Taro ran toward a wall, found some hidden mechanism. I saw in the crimson radiance that by the wall, 100 yards or so away, a big slide had opened. A small, gleaming, pot-bellied cylinder was standing there. It came automatically out on rollers and stopped in the open. A little 30-foot space flyer. And over it, high up, the ceiling of the vast cavern seemed to have opened. The murky purple red of the sky was up there. All this I saw in those few seconds. But there was far more here. A turmoil of sounds and moving, milling figures. A scene of weird, ghastly horror, so that for a moment I stood swaying with the limp body of Mac slung over my shoulders and my companions clustered around me. Down the slope where the little lay village stood under the trees in the red gloom, a crowd of lay were struggling. And everywhere among them, squat gray shapes of Raddick were plunging. Raddick with knives and scimitar-like swords, and some with rock chunks and bludgeons. Raddick screaming, running amok. I saw one lunge with a knife at a laywoman. The knife went into her and she fell, and the Raddick kept going until he crashed into a tree. The Great Mind was dead. Ratan, who might have taken his place, was dead. The mental force of all this little Raddick world was gone. The lay themselves had not been under its control. For generations they had been cowed, terrified into sullen obedience, but that was all. With the Raddicks it was different. They were born, bred, and trained to be automatons, to think what they were told to think. Mentally dominated, controlled so that the very essence of their mind was shaped and held together by their leader. And now they had no leader. For them, there was nothing left but mental chaos, so that gibbering with the insanity of minds unhinged, they were plunging here in wild, unreasoning chaos, obeying their instinct to kill. "My people, I must help them." Taro's unutterable horror at last found voice. He would have plunged down the slope with his young wife after him, but Vivian seized Tan, clung to her. I shouted at Shorty, "Hold him! Don't let him go!" Shorty hung on to him. "No, you don't." "You can't help them," I protested. "And we can't operate the spaceship. You want Earth people to help your world? Gotta get back there. We..." The words died in my throat. We all saw that none of us could get to the lay now, even if we had tried. A group of 100 or more of the screaming, gibbering Raddick had swept between us and the lay village. But the way to the spaceship still seemed open. We ran for it. One of the Raddick, by chance perhaps, turned toward us, and all the ones near him, like sheep, followed him. A horde of gray maniac things charging us. We got to the gleaming little cylinder with only an instant to spare, reached it, tumbled through its doorway. I laid Mac on the white grid of its floor. Shorty banged the door slide, hanged it as the bodies of the Raddick thudded against it. Taro ran for the controls, and in another instant the little ship quivered and lifted. There was a transparent bullseye window panel near me. For a second I had a glimpse of horrible, snarling, maniac faces pressed against it. Then they fell away, and in a moment we were out through the upper opening, slanting upward with the crimson surface of little Zelos dropping down. Then we were in space, with the brilliant, beautiful miracle of the universe glittering around us. I think there is a little more I need to add. You have all heard and read, of course, of the events of this past year, the secret of space flying. We have it now. Earth scientists studying the Raddick ship had no difficulty in constructing others far larger.
Fortunately, our Earth materials proved adaptable. There was nothing vital that we lacked. Many large ships were swiftly built, and an armed force went to Xelos. Haste was necessary, as you will recall, for when the mechanisms of the Radix were smashed, it was soon found that the Crimson Comet was plunging directly toward our sun. J. Walter Blaine wanted no publicity when he freely gave the millions necessary for the scientific research and the myriad activities which went into the building of the spaceships. You all offered your own donations, and they were refused only because Blaine felt he had earned the privilege of financing the enterprise. He wants me now to extend his thanks to you. Our first expedition to Xelos was when, in its sunward plunge, it had crossed our Earth orbit and was at its closest point to us. And the expedition found that no more than 1,000 of the Lay had been killed by the maniac Radix, who in those terrible hours after our departure plunged around screaming until they bashed themselves to destruction or were killed by the Lay. Taro and Tan were with our first expedition to the doomed little world, and they stayed there throughout all the several trips of the many big ships which evacuated the Lay. I am glad that it was finally decided not to bring the Lay here to Earth. They would have just been curiosities here, and then lost, whirled away into the maelstrom of our huge world. Surely it was the best of good fortune for them when our exploring ships found that Venus was uninhabited and with conditions for life so propitious. And now the Lay, with Taro and Tan to lead them, are masters of a great world of their own, with the friendly world of Earth nearest to them. Surely we will prove a helpful, friendly, neighboring world, with no greedy thought of anything more than that. Xelos is gone now. I was one of those who saw it go, that night about a month ago. It was a little dot in the sky, with a great flaming streamer of the sun licking upward as though eager to meet it, and then it was gone. I recall the earnest solicitations of so many of you who prayed that Mac would get well. He wants me to thank you all again. I saw him only last week, in the little mountain home where he and Vivian went after their wedding trip. That astoundingly pretentious wedding they had. Well, that was because Blaine insisted on doing it. He may insist again, if and when a layette is needed. I don't know about that. But Mac, who now has an executive position in one of Blaine's many industries, got their little house himself. He and Vivian remained firm on that. And as I said at the beginning, you must see now that none of us are glamorous heroes. We're all at our regular jobs, with the Crimson Comet just a gruesome memory. So now, kind friends, please forget us. Except me. I'm certainly no hero, but well, I don't mind if you'll remember that I broadcast twice a week on subjects of popular astronomy. Station WANA, NYC. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Yesterday's Sci-Fi. This has been Juggernaut of Space by Ray Cummings, published in fall of 1945 in a publication called Planet Stories. This story kind of had everything, right? It had alien abduction. It had, you know, apocalypse, world-ending threat. It had a little bit of romance. It had fights to the death. It had strange creatures and space travel and futuristic weapons. A little bit longer of a story than I usually do, but this is kind of fun to get into a little bit of a bigger story, a little deeper. And I really enjoyed this one. So I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. For all things Yesterday Sci-Fi, head on over to yesterdayscifi.com or hit me up on Twitter @yesterdayscifi. This has been Adam Tagaro reading Yesterday's Science Fiction to you.